The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Yesterday we spoke about education. What is education? Today what I want to deal with is what is religion, what is truth, and what is faith. I mean, basically Judaism claims it's a religion. That's actually a little difficult. Is it a religion or not? But for now, the general thought is that we are studying a religion. But before we can study religion, we have to figure out what is a religion. Okay? What is a religion? So any suggestions on what is a religion? It's right. A religion is a set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody is going to include in that set of beliefs a God. Right? That doesn't make it any less a set of beliefs. You follow? In other words, there's reality, and then there's your set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality, and regarding the relationship between yourself and reality. And that's basically a religion in its most broadest term. Now, with that kind of definition realized, then everybody is religious. Because everybody has a set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality, regarding the nature of their relationship to reality. Okay? So everyone actually has a religion, if that's what a religion is, and that really is what a religion is. So now, let's think about this. I've met a lot of people who say, I'm not religious. Not me, right? But they say that they themselves are not religious. And that's a funny thing to say. Because when you think of it in the most broadest term, we're all religious. Meaning we all have a set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality. All right? Not only are we all religious, but we all actually have our own set of laws, our own set of halachot, our own set of mitzvot. Why? Because your set of beliefs will influence your behavior. Okay? You will have your do's and your don'ts. Let's think about this. Let's say you have a set of beliefs where you believe that the world is a dog-eat-dog world. What an icky world, no? Dogs eating each other. But that's your belief, okay? That's your set of belief, dog-eat-dog world. What would then be the implicit set of laws? What would be one of your thou shalt nots? Think about this. So thou shalt deceive other people because, you know, they're out to get you. Right? We all have a set of beliefs. And those set of beliefs imply a certain set of behavioral patterns, a certain set of halachot. And so if your set of beliefs is that it's a dog-eat-dog world, then you will have thou shalt rip off thy neighbor. Right? That would be your personal law. Can someone suggest a set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality? That's all reality. It's whatever you can touch, feel, and see. So then what would be the implicit thou shalt of that?
Thou shalt trust only what you can touch.
Ah, do you see? That's the way it works. So let's say you've got a set of beliefs that the nature of reality is very compassionate, loving, and forgiving. What would then be your implicit halachot, your implicit laws, your thou shalt? Right? What would you live with?
That way, with compassion and forgiveness.
True, because you would feel in order to be compatible with reality, being that reality is the context of our existence, right? That would be the implicit behavior. Let's say you believe that reality is very cold, very rigid, very scientific. Everything is cause and effect. What then would be your personal halachot? Well, you'd probably sense that you get what you deserve. You'd be a very justice-oriented, everything's cause and effect. There's no such thing as forgiveness there, right? I just want to demonstrate that we all really have a set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality, and that set of beliefs indicate, right, dictate a certain set of laws that we behave according to. Now, so when a person says, I'm not really religious, that's not really true. And a person says, well, I'm not really interested. Why would I want to live a life based on various laws and various disciplines? You already are, right? We're all living a life based on a certain set of beliefs, and we're all adhering to a very complex system of laws that most of us aren't even aware of. We're not even aware of the thou shalt and the thou shalt nots of our own lives, right? But we're already under the influence. So I find it a little strange when people say, oh, this person has blind faith, right? To a certain extent, we are all under the influence of a certain blind faith, because we all have this set of beliefs, and we all have these set of behavioral do's and don'ts, which we are functioning and adhering to. The question is, where did you get your set of beliefs? Okay? Where did you get your set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality? So, most probably the first place is your parents. Okay? Because the first reality that you encounter is your home. Your home is the world. Okay? So let's say you're raised in a home where mommy and daddy are fighting all the time, right? And have absolutely no time to, in any way, relate to you. Well, what then would be your set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality? Well, you feel like nobody cares, right? And I'm all alone, and if not for me, who is for me, right? And that's all, right? Let's say you're in a home where you have these big towering brothers, and they're always picking on you. Right? Well, what would be your set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality? Well, I'm always being subordinated. There are forces that are out to get me. And then what would be your personal halacha, your personal thou shalt? Get them first. Do you follow? You have a set of beliefs. And most probably the first source for your set of beliefs is the particular situation of your home. Right? Your home is a certain terrain. And based on that terrain, you draw up a map. How to get along in this environment. How to get what I need to get. How do I protect myself? How do I survive? Alright? Well, it's not just family, of course, because there's more sources for your personal beliefs. What else? Your friends. This is, again, very subjective and very relative to the situation. You were raised in Harlem. You were raised in the ghetto. You were raised, right? And your friends are of such, and you have certain personal experiences which seem to tell you, you know, if you were a person who many of your earlier years you felt you were being manipulated, then most probably you'd have a certain set of beliefs that, you know, life is out to get you, life is manipulating, or if you were in an environment where people are very supportive and loving and always forgiving, then your personal set of beliefs is the world is very forgiving and loving, and, you know, you make a mistake, it's not the worst thing. Do you follow? It's very important to understand that, really, it's funny that a person could say, I'm not religious, when you're more than religious than you could ever even imagine. You already have a very clear set of beliefs. You're already influenced by a personal set of halachot, a personal set of laws. And the problem is that most of us don't even know what those set of beliefs are, nor are we aware of the various thou shalts and thou shalt nots that are influencing us. And they are derived predominantly from our family situation, as well as our unique social situation, as well as our personal experiences, which, you know, will be a function of that. A person was in an accident, or a person's father was a drunk, or, right? And you have a set of beliefs. Okay, but is it really, how is it transmitted? Okay, certainly I'm in a home and I'm drawing up a map, and in my map I'm coming up, well, it's bumpy here, so there's hills here and there's mountains, and life is very mountainous, or life is really smooth and life is like a river. Who knows, right, what your map might be. But how is that really conveyed? Is it conveyed just verbally? I mean, there really are a lot of people whose parents are very religious. And for some reason, this person, this child, is an atheist. I mean, have you met somebody like that, whose parent and whose whole family situation, they went to some Sunday school, they went to some religious school, and they ended up in some strange way being atheistic? Or have you met somebody, I mean, I've met people, who was raised in a family which was very non-believing, you know, an atheistic home, and the child is really looking for God. I mean, I've had people call me up and say, I don't know what's wrong with my son. Our whole life we taught them there's no God. And why? Where did we go wrong? He's on a spiritual search. He's looking for God. I don't know what's wrong. Rabbi, can you help me? My son believes in God. You know, well, what's going on? How could that be? If the family situation is so strong, and it really is very strong, and they have a great command of determining your set of beliefs regarding nature, reality, and the nature of your relationship to reality, so then how is it possible that a child born in a family, raised in a family of atheists, could be a devout, religious, spiritual searcher, you know, believing in God? Why? How could that have happened? Well, could be, but I think one thing we have to realize is your set of beliefs is not generally expressed verbally. Your set of beliefs is more directly expressed through your behavior, okay? Through your behavior. In other words, your family could say they don't believe in God. They could say that they don't believe in creation. And they could say that they believe in a Big Bang, but they treat people, right, like creations. They treat people with incredible respect. They treat every human being as the creation of God. So even though they say they don't believe in God, their behavior seems to be indicating that they do believe in what we would call God. However, you could be in a family who is, so to speak, devoutly religious. And they told their kids, say, Shema every day and go to shul every day and keep Shabbos. And yet this child is living, growing up and feeling like, I don't relate to any of this and I don't even think there's a God. And how is that possible? It's very possible. Because although their parents said in words they believe in God, in actions they treated people like dirt. They treated people like big accidents. They treated people like children of big bangs. And so, of course, what do you expect? Right? Why would you think your child would believe in God? So, we have a set of beliefs, and we have a system of laws which is a direct reflection and implication of those set of beliefs. And those set of beliefs we draw from our family, our friends, our personal environment, and yet that set of beliefs very often is not what you even say you think they are. Right? That's what makes it so difficult. That very often we're not even in touch with what we really believe. We're not really in touch with what is our perception of reality as well as what is our personal thou shalt and thou shalt not. And sometimes only from somebody objective says, do you know that the way you behave is really neurotic? And me? Neurotic? What do you mean? You know, and the person was like, yeah, really, you're very neurotic, or you're very this, you're very that. And you say, me? I'm not. Right? Everybody else is. Very often, the critique that we have of others is most often the very problem we ourselves have. Because generally, we're more sensitive of our own problems as it's reflected in other people. So we often talk lashon hara, nasty things about other people, how they are X. When in fact, very often, we're precisely X. And that's why we're so sensitive about it in other people. So, what does it mean to grow up? And what does it mean to truly be mature? What does it mean to be healthy? Can you imagine how frustrating it must be to be in Rome with a map of Jerusalem? You didn't know it was a map of Jerusalem. But you're in Rome, and here you've got this map, and this map, you know, the top of it was ripped off, so it doesn't say Jerusalem. And somebody hands it to you and says, you know, enjoy yourself in Rome. Could you imagine how nuts you would be? Right? You're looking for the washroom, it says it's 2 blocks to the left, and you end up in a fountain. Right? And you're looking for a pharmaceutical and, a pharmacy, and what do you end up? You know, you end up at an ice cream parlor. And you go nuts, right? You after a while begin to feel that the map right? Which is apparently a reflection of the terrain, is not, okay? And it's very, very frustrating. There was a woman in the last program who said that she had traveled so many little cities and little towns in Italy that she often did get the maps, you know, switched, because they all seemed very similar, but there were those nuances, and it was like driving you nuts. What's going on? Well, so that's the problem of growing up. The problem of growing up is we have a certain set of beliefs. We've drawn up a map which reflects the terrain as we so personally, uniquely encountered it in our family environment, in our social environment, and now we're in the big world, and we're using the map which was the map which reflected the terrain of our home, but might not at all reflect the terrain of reality as it truly is. Okay? Now, the level of psychological health would be that your set of beliefs indeed accurately reflect reality as it truly is. Do you follow? Right? Because we all have a set of beliefs, but maybe our set of beliefs doesn't work. Maybe our set of beliefs is really not an accurate reflection of reality as it is. It only reflected what my home was like, right? Or my unique situation in that particular time period was like, okay? But who says life, the big life out there, is anything like that? We don't know. Well, so the difficulty in growing up is being able to mature in a way that I'm open to recognize that maybe my map is not accurate. And maybe my set of beliefs do not truly reflect the terrain of life. And maybe the behavior that my set of beliefs was implying is incongruent with the real movement of the universe. Okay? And that's what we would call the search for truth. Okay? That's what we would call then the search for truth. Because what is truth? That is truth. 2 + 2 = 4. That's truth. Right? That's truth. What is truth? Whatever is, is. And now we're trying to articulate it. Okay? We're trying to establish a set of beliefs that accurately reflect is. Okay? So I just as a little experiment to help you, I want you to all close your eyes. Close your eyes and keep them closed for an hour. No, close your eyes. I'm generally pretty good at getting people to close their eyes. You know, rabbis. Okay? So close your eyes. And I'm going to hand to two people something that you don't know what it is. And I want you to pass it to the next person. And right when you finish getting it, you can then open your eyes and don't look, right? Write in your notebook, something like that, what you thought it was. And then we'll talk about this. Right? What did you think it was? Did everybody think that? Did anyone think it was something else? So how many people thought it was a candle? Now, the point being is such, whatever it was, right? There's nothing we can argue about that, okay? But now we are trying to describe it. And someone thought it was wood, and you're wrong, right? And someone thought it was a candle, and you're right. So there is a wrong in the right, but there is what is, okay? Now reality is, and it's kind of hard to argue with reality. Reality is, because that's the definition of reality is. Now, we are trying to describe it. Okay? We are trying to describe it, to articulate it. Truth is the most accurate description of is. But of course, will it then be absolute, or is it possibly relative? Okay? So right now, we are embracing reality, and we are describing reality. But will it be absolute or will it be relative? Yes?
I think it will have to be relative, because every person who would try to explain or describe what it is affected by their own beliefs and their own perceptions. So there's no one person that has a clear perception of everything that is.
Okay. So first of all, you still see that just about everybody thought it was a candle. So there is a way to come to a common ground description of what it is, right? But I would agree that there would be a certain relative, because as the old metaphor goes, if we all are holding on to an elephant, well, I might say an elephant is long and lanky and hairy because I happen to be hanging on to his tail. Another one might say, well, an elephant was really thick and stocky because I happened to be holding on to his legs, okay? And yet, does that mean that I'm wrong or that I'm right? Okay? So interestingly enough, in Judaism, we believe that truth is absolute, but there still is a relative quality to truth, okay? Which is a function of your unique encounter with what is, okay? So in a manner of speaking, there's is, and then there's Judaism, right? Which is the Jewish encounter with is. There might be Buddhism, which is the Buddha encounter with is, okay? Is. And now we're trying to describe it, right? And we might discover that is not an it, because that's a little too impersonal, okay? But we describe is, and we discover that we might have a unique encounter with is, which might then be relative to us. So what we would find is there would be a certain dimension which would be absolute, and then there would be a certain quality which is relative, right? In other words, not everybody would then agree with everything Judaism says about is, because there's a certain unique encounter that the Jews have with is, as well as the rest of the world, their unique encounter with is. So there's a certain quality of relativity, and yet there's still a quality of the absolute, okay? And it's very hard that, well, is it absolute, is it relative? It's kind of beyond the either-or. And we find in the Torah there are basic absolutes, and then there are certain relativities which are a function of time, a function of people. There are disputes in the Talmud, right? And the Talmud says, well, we go according to this opinion now, but in the future we'll go according to that opinion. Well, which opinion is right? Well, we believe both opinions are right based on certain time periods in terms of the relationship to reality. But then there are certain principles that are absolute. Okay? So in terms of religion is a set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality. Right? But what would make a true religion? A true religion would be a religion whose set of beliefs accurately describe the nature of reality in the most all-encompassing way. Now, this brings us to what we claimed, or what Judaism claims about Moses. We said that Moses, according to the Kabbalah, viewed through a clear lens. Okay? As you said, there would be a certain amount of relativity because it would be a function of your personality, perhaps, a function of your particular frame reference, you know, your point of reference. But that's why the Kabbalah says that Moses did not have a point of reference that was unique to him, right, as an individual. But rather, his encounter with reality, right, was so all-encompassing without any screen, right, that filtered out from a subjective point of view. Therefore, Judaism claims that Moses' encounter with reality and the set of beliefs which he was more of a revelation rather than just simply figuring something out is the most accurate manifestation, right, representation of reality as it truly is. With a set of behavior, right, a set of laws which of many are universally applicable and which of many are uniquely appropriate to the Jews. All right? Uniquely appropriate to, in terms of a Jew is responsible to eat kosher, but a non-Jew is not responsible to eat kosher. Why? Right, well, different strokes for different folks. It has to do with the nature of our relationship to is, right? And our, so to speak, responsibility within that encounter. So, what I'm trying to indicate is such. It doesn't seem fair for a person to say they're not religious, because we're all religious. We all have a set of beliefs. It's really unfortunate for a person to say, you know, why would I ever want to submit myself to a rigorous life under the influence of laws? You already are under a rigorous life under the influence of laws. The question is, as a person matures, you want to ask yourself, is my set of beliefs, right? First of all, what are my set of beliefs? Which could take a long time, which a therapist might help you with, in terms of really finding out what is my set of beliefs and how is it influencing my behavior. That's number one. But number two is Judaism claims to have a set of beliefs, which is the truth. Meaning, Judaism claims that its set of beliefs regarding reality is the clearest, most precise articulation of reality as it is. That the map of Torah is the most precise map of reality. Okay, that's the claim of Judaism. Okay, I'm not saying you have to believe that, right? But you'll have to explore that, but I have to tell you that this is what Judaism certainly claims. Judaism is ready to accept that there are other prophets, and there might be other ways which are reflecting reality, but they will not be the same degree of precision, right? And they will certainly not be appropriate for the Jews. Okay, so if I got a guy from the East who comes up to me and says, listen, our sages taught us an ancient tradition that wisdom comes through putting ashes on my eyebrows. Well, as a religious Jew, do I have to argue that? Right? Do I have to feel all of a sudden threatened by that? Oh yeah? Moses didn't say that. I don't feel threatened by that. I say, well, all the best to you. And you know, and maybe your prophets told you. I don't know. I have no need at all, right? To refute that, right? Because unless they come and say, listen, my prophet says that you, as a Jew, should put ashes in your eyelid. Well, so then I'm sorry, right? Because we have our prophet. And we believe that our prophet had the most all-encompassing view of reality, the most all-encompassing encounter with reality. And really, it wasn't his, but it was prophetically told. Who could know reality better than God? In other words, Torah claims to be a revelation, which is not our set of beliefs regarding reality, but the set of beliefs regarding reality that God wants us to believe, right? And you should know, who knows if they're accurate, right? That's not the point. The point is that these are the set of beliefs that have been revealed, which is, so to speak, the divine, most all-encompassing articulation revealed to this extremely objective individual, okay? With various laws which are implicit of that system, okay, of that set of beliefs. So that's where the challenge becomes very difficult. Because Judaism claims that its set of beliefs is the most accurate, that the set of beliefs is the best map, and that the kind of frustration that a person should feel by having the wrong map in the wrong city is not what they would feel if they had an appropriate map. Okay? And that would be what truth is. So what is faith? Okay? Now, so religion is a set of beliefs. Truth is the most accurate articulation, right, which reflects reality as is. It is a set of beliefs which accurately describe reality as it is in terms of your unique relationship to reality. Okay? Now, what is faith? Okay? There's no such thing as faith in Judaism. There's no word for faith in Judaism. The word that most people translate as faith is emunah. Okay? But emunah doesn't literally mean faith. Emunah comes from the word ne'eman, which means faithful. Okay? And it comes from the word omanut, which means portrayal, artistry. Okay? So what is faith? See, for the Jews, faith isn't a person going around saying, I believe this, and I believe that, and I believe this, and I believe that. I don't care what you say. Right? I want to see what you do. Okay? I want to see a behavioral pattern. Right? Because that is a much more authentic, much more direct expression of your set of beliefs. Okay? Emunah isn't a person saying, I believe in God. Emunah is a person who treats people like creations of God. Right? And a person who says, I believe in God, and treat people like dirt, they don't believe in God. I mean, they might say they believe in God. Well, that's very nice, but they're not very much in touch with themselves because in essence, they don't really believe in God. Because they are in no way behaving in a manner which is indicative of that set of beliefs. Okay? So, emunah is really not a statement in essence. Emunah is an action, right? And emunah, which is the source of all mitzvot, right? All the mitzvot in Judaism is really an expression of emunah, okay? And in Kabbalah, the last attribute, which is malchut, is what's called emunah, because emunah translates your encounter with reality in a behavioral way. That's really what emuna is. Okay? And you would be, in a manner, you would be portraying reality. Okay? That's what you would do. In other words, if I walk down the street and I see someone punch another person in the face, I would say there's something wrong with that. Why is there something wrong with that? All right? Because that behavior is not an accurate reflection of how I intuit what reality is. Do you follow? Right? It's incongruent with the way reality is. Okay? I see a person, you know, barge into a bank with a gun and say, stick them up, hand over all your money. Something inside me says, no, that's not the way. It's obviously not flashing in his mind, but my mind, I say, no. Now, what did I base that on? That I just said, no, I don't think that's appropriate. It's based on that behavior is not portraying reality as it is. In other words, a person is an artist. And an artist is conveying a certain encounter. Okay? And the mitzvah, in many ways, is really artistry. Okay? So one lifestyle could accurately describe reality, and another lifestyle might be portraying a falsity. All right? That's really what emunah is supposed to be in Judaism. Okay? Not people walking around saying, I believe in this, and you believe in that, and we believe in that, the other. No. It's your behavior. For that reason, Judaism isn't so philosophical as many people would like it to have been. Right? When you go into Jerusalem, you come to Jerusalem, you want to look at Jewish spirituality. So you go to a Jewish study hall, and what do you see people doing there? Sitting around, you know, on this Talmudic text, you know, if a cow hits a flower pot that falls on a person's head, and that person screams, which causes the cat to be frightened, which runs into the street, and this person swerves, who pays? That's Judaism, right? Now, that's spirituality, you call it spirituality? We call that emunah, right? In other words, we want to know, how do you behave, right? What is my responsibility? So the interesting thing is, Judaism labors greatly regarding halakha. What do you do, right? And of course there are philosophical texts, but relative to the amount of halakhic text and the amount of work gone into the halakhic dimension of Judaism, most people would feel a little uncomfortable. You know, I'd like to meditate, I'd like to this, I'd like to that, right? Contemplate. And yet in a funny way, Judaism is action, right? It's really action. Because Judaism is a set of beliefs articulated in the vocabulary of behavior. Okay? That's really what it ultimately is. The behavior is the most accurate description of what Jews really believe and how that belief influences them, okay, according to their behavior. And that's why halakha is so important, because the halakha is the most direct way of really knowing what Jews believe, because it's emunah. It is a portrait of our encounter with reality. It is a demonstration of our faithfulness to reality as it is. And so what is reality? Right? Reality is what we call Hashem. In other words, I don't believe in God. As a Jew, I don't believe in God. Right? Who's G-O-D? Where did that word come from? Okay? Rather, I believe in is. And that's the word. The Yud, the He, the Vav, and the He, which when we see that name for God, we say Adonai. What does that come from? It comes from the word Havaya. And when we say it, we are to think, was, is, will be. And that's what the Jewish people believe. We believe in the was, is, will be. And we have a set of beliefs regarding the nature of was, is, will be, and the nature of our relationship to was, is, will be. And that's who we believe in. Okay? God, I know it's a word that after many years was associated with, you know, the divine. Okay? But I don't know. Yeah, if I feel comfortable with that word G-O-D anymore. Okay? You know, it's very nice on money and God we trust, but I don't know if that many people really, God they trust. I think they trust in Washington on the bill. So, what does it really mean then to study Judaism? Well, it's very difficult. because it becomes sometimes a clash of set of beliefs. And so if we're going to be open to study Judaism, we have to be open to say, wait a second, this set of beliefs may reflect reality as it is. Okay? And that's what I want to explore. Right? That's what I want to explore. But when a person comes in and say, look, I just want to read this stuff, I just want to learn about this stuff, it's not really fair. Right? Well, you know, I'm not really a religious personality. We're all religious personalities. Right? Well, I'm not really a halakhic personality, I'm not interested in law. We're all under the influence of a law. The question is, how do you know your set of beliefs and the law that you're already adhering to best reflects reality as it truly is? So Judaism claims that it is a system that most precisely reflects reality. It is. Judaism claims it has a lifestyle that best portrays and expresses a devotion to reality as it truly is, right? And therefore it will work. Okay? And therefore it has worked. Right? Which is pretty amazing, because Judaism has worked for thousands and thousands of years. That doesn't mean there are not other forms of lifestyle that might have worked. Okay, but I think every historian has been overwhelmed by the unique ability for the Jews to survive. Okay, what's their secret? What do they got? What do they know? What's enabled them to keep going? Okay, and that's all part of what we're trying to explore here. So now let's hear some questions on what we just talked about.
I'm still confused about the difference between an absolute reality and yet a subjective relative interpretation of it, so that you're talking about people living according to what is, but do you understand my confusion?
Yeah, well, so we've got a bottle. It is objectively a bottle, okay? Now, I might call it a lamp, you might call it a table, it doesn't really matter. It is a bottle, right? And bottle would be the best word that would actually describe it. Okay? That's what it is. So to reality, whatever it is, okay? And we're trying to describe it. And we're trying to live in accordance with it so that we're not out of whack with reality. Okay? That's all we're trying to do. Okay? And Judaism claims that it has the most accurate description of reality because it's a description of reality that we got from God. Okay? That was revealed truth. Not a function of, you know, a long time. In other words, when a person is looking for a map, okay, who really offers maps for life in this world? Well, I mean, there are people in the world that offer life maps. Who are they? Think about it. Who are they?
There are a lot of people.
Well, so, not specifically, what are the categories?
Philosophers, religions.
And?
Friends.
So there's philosophers, there's prophets, and they're psychologists. What?
Artists
don't really offer a way of life.
No,
not so much.
An authentic map of reality as they've seen it.
Yeah, but not as in terms of a way of life, a map that tells you where you are and where you came from and how you can get to.
Yeah.
I think basically the three professions that are into map making, even science is interested in basically quantifying reality, categorizing reality, it doesn't really offer, and there's really no reason to expect it to offer us, you know, some insights in how to live our lives and how to kind of like, how to journey the terrain of living. They don't do that, right? They're very nice people, right? And they've offered an incredible amount of insight. But bottom line, it's not as if that's really what concerned them. So what you have is philosophers who have a claim to figure it out and have a set of beliefs which would accurately describe the nature of reality and the nature of how we kind of jump in and swim. You have psychologists who would certainly, I think, say that they have a grip on the nature of reality, nature of human beings, and how to function and how to be healthy and how to coordinate oneself in the world. And then you have prophets. Okay, so we pick up the yellow pages because we're looking for a life map. And it's very simple because they're all in the P section. And it's just fantastic because in the center of Manhattan is one building for all the life map makers in the world, right? There's the life map building in Manhattan. And so we go to the building and we say, well, you know, well, who are we going to go to first? Because we would like to find a working, accurate set of beliefs with its appropriate behavioral style to live, right? Which would be then called truth, right? Well, so who would you go to first? Because you know, you only have, God willing, 120 years, so you got to move it, and there's a lot of them out there. So, you know, who would you go to first? Who would you go to first? A philosopher? Would you go to a psychologist? Would you go to a prophet? Anybody? You go to a psychologist first. Why would you go to a psychologist first?
I don't know, it's just my gut instinct to do it. What?
All right, anybody else? Yeah?
I'd probably go to a psychologist first also, because I think to know like a way that you want to live your life, you might want to find out from them, like evaluate your psychology and your past, and have someone sit there and be as an objective person.
But they can tell you about who you are, but are they going to tell you about who you are in relationship to reality?
Well, they'll
help clarify your main beliefs about reality and what you want.
Oh, so they help you clarify what your beliefs are. Yeah, that's the problem. Based on their beliefs, because are you going to go to a Freudian? Are you going to a Jungian? Are you going to go to a Ferrucci? And there's all these other guys. I mean, who are you going to go to?
But what about if you go to, you know, prophet or religious person, intuition.
Personally, I would say if I actually could find someone that I felt comfortably did have a prophetic experience whereby information was conveyed, communicated to them, well, then that would be probably the most accurate map I could find. I might not be satisfied with the prophets, but at least start off. Well, so that's really easy. So we go to the third floor, the prophecy floor of the map, the life map building of Manhattan. And now we've got to decide, because there's a lot of prophets out there. So who are the prophets that are offering maps? Who are the prophets that are offering maps of life, that are claiming they have the truth, which is the articulation of reality as it truly is, and the lifestyle that would most make you compatible with reality?
Okay,
so who are the prophets in the world, the famous world prophets?
Buddha.
Okay, so you got Muhammad, you got Buddha, you got Jesus, and you got Moses. Okay, that's basically the four biggies. There's a couple small-time prophets, which you might want to explore. But, basically, in terms of the big ones in the world, those are basically the prophets. Now, which one would you go to first? If you're Jewish, I'm sure it wouldn't be Moses. But, unfortunately, which one should you go to first when you think of it? I mean, you want to save time. You don't want to waste time, right? You want to do this, right? You want to do this efficiently. So which one would make the most sense to start off with?
I might go to Jesus first.
Yeah, why?
Because all things being equal, he would claim to actually be either the Son of God or a God, you know? So maybe that'd be the most direct expression.
Problem is, he never claimed he was God. So that's a problem.
Okay.
He never claimed he was a God. In fact, a lot of Christians have problems with it too, because it's something that evolved after periods of time in terms of identifying him as a Godhead. But not all of them think he's God, but might be Son of God. But then again, the Bible says we're all sons of God.
But what about them who claim to have revelation from God?
Oh, well, they're all claiming that. Moses is claiming he's got a revelation from God. Mohammed's claiming he's got a revelation from God. So why would you go to Jesus first?
Moses or a Zen master.
So why would you go to Moses?
But why not go to Jesus first? Well,
we want to be efficient about this. We only have 120 years to live.
He did say, I am the way and the truth.
A lot of them said that.
But given the fact that this is a life map building, that someone might say to you, I am the way.
Let me suggest. So you walk into the office of Jesus, right? Want a meeting with JC? Okay, and I'm not talking Johnny Cash. So I'd like to meet. But I was talking Johnny Carson. Okay. So all right, fine. So I have this meeting with Jesus. Can't imagine it, but and I say to him, okay, you're a prophet. One Jew to another, right? You know, between us yids, okay? Tell me, what are your credentials? What are your credentials? You claim you are a prophet, and you claim you are the way. What are your credentials? Well, what will he say to you? He will say, hey, I am the Messiah, as prophesied by the Jewish prophets. Well, that means that I will have to accept the Jewish prophets, because you got nothing if I don't accept the Jewish prophets. And I don't know if I have accepted the Jewish prophets yet. I haven't even met them yet. So that wouldn't be an efficient way to research truth, because his whole trip is based on the Jewish prophecy.
But what if he said, and I also was resurrected from the dead, you know?
No, he wouldn't say that. Because I asked him. No, he wouldn't say that.
And I rose, you know, even after I was dead, you know, and I have millions of followers around the world. They're probably right. There are so many of them.
But you'll still say, what's the foundation of your prophecy? He's going to say to you, Moses. He's got to say to you, Moses. That's right. So you can't accept anything he's got to say unless you have a handle on what Moses has got to say.
Okay, then what about a Hindu master?
So we'll get to the Hindu masters in a second. So let's go to Buddha. Why not? Right? And he's next door anyways. Right? Next office. So we go into the office of Buddha, and we say we want to meet Buddha. He's sitting on his table, right? Right? And we say, I'm looking for a life map. I'm looking for a prophet. And what would Buddha say to you?
Prophet.
That's right. He'd say, I'm not a prophet. I'm on the wrong floor. There's just no room on the floor of the philosophers because I'm not a prophet. Buddha never claimed he was a prophet. Right? So he might be in the top of the list of the philosophers or the top of the list of psychologists because he was brilliant. I mean, it's clear that Buddhism is no pushover, right? But I'm starting off with prophets because if I could find someone who has reasonable credentials that they had a prophetic experience, I'd be in pretty good business. Well, so we're going through it, right? So we're now it's a hard one because it's between Moses and Mohammed. Well, so M-O, it's a little difficult. M-O-H, M-O-S, Mohammed. I'll go to Mohammed. And of course, I'm Jewish. I wouldn't go to Moses. So I go to Mohammed. Okay, so now I go into Mohammed and I say, well, tell me, you know, you're a prophet and I heard that you stepped on a rock and went up to heaven and they still, you know, have the crevice in the rock where you stepped. Tell me, what are your credentials? What is the foundation of your prophecy? And he's going to say, Moses. Right? And you're going to say, why is everybody talking about Moses? I'm going to be stuck because I'm going to have millions of people throughout the world, whether they're Muslims or whether they're Christians, all basing their religion and their life maps on this one man called Moses. Okay? And so, again, I don't know if he's a prophet. But if he is a prophet, my gosh, I'd be in great business over here because I would have a life map that is really accurate. Okay, so then I go into Moses and I say to Moses, what are your credentials? And he says, 3 million people witnessed my prophecy. That's a pretty heavy claim, right? That's a really crazy claim. And I say, where do you come up with something like that? He says, well, listen, millions of people believe it too, right? Now, it's not proof, but it carries weight. I think it's worth considering. As well as when I say, okay, well, let's open up your book, your 5 books of prophecy, and let's explore it. And what happens when I discover that in this book, there is the deepest, most insightful guidance towards life that I would find Freud, Jung, you know, like it incorporates all of that, right, and much more, I'd be pretty impressed. Okay, I'd be pretty impressed. Now again, I'm not trying to prove to you, right. But I'm trying to help share what is the process for the search of truth. And, you know, it's a sad thing because if you were to go home and say to your friends, hey, I'm religious, they would think you said a dirty word. I mean, you know, you'd feel really uncomfortable saying, hey, now I'm religious. You know, it's just like, what's wrong with you? But the first thing is to help people understand you're all religious. And in fact, most people are of a greater blind faith than the people who are claiming they're religious. Because at least they're honest about it. At least they're honest about saying, hey, listen, I have a set of beliefs. And hey, listen, I function according to a lifestyle which is a direct expression of my set of beliefs. Everybody's doing that. Right? But not everybody's asking themselves, well, what's the source of my set of beliefs? And how do I know my set of beliefs accurately reflect the way reality truly is? That's the question that I believe most people should be asking themselves. Or at least spending a little time in a life map school. You know, a week, two, three. You know, today, unfortunately, people go to courses on everything. You know, how to build a canoe. right? How to use your PC, your personal computer. You know, how to feed your goldfish tofu. I don't know. You know, I mean, there's all these courses that people go to. But how many people ask themselves, my gosh, if I were to receive in the mail this $3 million worth computer, how many people would just simply open up the package and start banging away, right? Trying to figure out how this thing works. You really wouldn't take that chance. You would ask yourself, is there, you know, some kind of manual? Is there some kind of instruction? Is there some kind of diagram that reflects how to, what to push, what not to push? That's how people would deal with it, responsibly. It's a sad thing, but people are more responsible about their possessions than their own lives, right? Very often. Because very often people do not take the time to say, hey, who am I? What am I? What is this world all about? What are my set of beliefs? Are they accurate? Right? Are they directing me in a manner which would be upright and fulfilling or not? Okay? And then when they finally do that, you know, I met this Jews for Jesus. And I was at this concert, the Shlomo Kalba concert. And this guy was really getting off of the music. I happened to be having a cap on. I didn't have my kippah. And this guy comes up to me and says, hey, I saw you were really getting off on the concert. So I said, yeah, I liked it. It was really nice. He said, yeah, I really enjoyed it too. And he said, are you interested in religion? He didn't know I'm a rabbi. So I said, yeah, a little bit. You know? So I said, what about you? He said, oh, yeah, I'm also interested in it. I said, oh, wow. He said, maybe we'll get together and talk sometime. He says, yeah, I don't mind. Let's get together and talk sometime. So we exchanged phone numbers. And when the guy walked out of the room, this guy comes up to me and says, do you know who you just spoke to? I said, no. He said, he's Jews for Jesus. So I said, but you know what's even more funny? He doesn't know who he just spoke to because I'm a rabbi, right? He picked the wrong guy. So I said, great. So I called him up. I don't know, it was like Jerry. I said, hey, Jerry, it's David. You know, we met at the concert. You want to get together and schmooze, you know, like talk. So he said, oh, that'd be great. Let's go out, you know, and talk a little, you know. So I said, fine. The whole time, I know, I'm going to tell him I'm a rabbi, right? So we're walking in the park, having a good time, and we're talking about religion, and he's telling me about the prophets, and he's telling me all these things, and then he starts telling me about the prophet Yeshua. So I said to him, you know, I don't really know that much about religion, but I've never really heard of the prophet Yeshua. So he starts giving me this whole trip about the prophet Yeshua, and I start asking him basic questions about it, you know, because obviously I have studied this whole thing, and he was becoming very uncomfortable because he realized that I'm asking these questions that he can't answer. So I said to him, you know, I have done studying in religion, and really in terms of this prophet Yeshua, there's not that much basis for his for him. So he got all flustered and upset and emotional, and he told me, he says, you don't understand, Jesus saves. Right? Like he started really getting into that. And so I said to him, how do you know Jesus saves? Okay? So he says, because when I accepted the wafer and the wine, doors started opening up in my life. Right? Doors started opening up in my life. So I said to him, that's the Satan. Right? Because that's the way they talk. So he said, Satan? That's not the Satan. I said, how do you know it's not the Satan? Right? He says, no, it couldn't be the Satan. I said, well, maybe it is the Satan. Maybe the Satan is seducing you. And like they always talk about the Satan. So I was just using his lingo. Right? Now how does he know? He got really upset. He was freaking out. And you could just see where this guy's coming from. I said, how did you get into this stuff in the first place? Right? So he happened to meet this guy. I mean, it's a very irresponsible way to get involved in something. You happen to meet this guy, and they invite him over to this Friday night thing, and da-da-da, it was like this, you know. So I said to him, you know, I would like you to meet a very special person. Her name is Esther Youngrice. Now, she happened to be speaking that Sunday in Toronto. So I said, come on, let's catch her. Let's see if we can speak to her. So I said, you know, she's really incredible. She's really unbelievable, and I'm really building her up. So just as we get over into the synagogue and people are walking out, she just finished her lecture, and you hear, and she gets a lot of old people too, so you get these old people saying, oh, she's a prophet, she's at this, she's at that, she's unbelievable. And you hear all these people like really so amazed by Esther Youngrice. And Esther Youngrice comes out, and I don't know her from beans. I mean, I don't know her, she doesn't know me, but I said, oh, Esther, I want to introduce you to a good friend of mine. Okay? So I brought him in front of her, and she looks at him, and she says, yes, right? And I said, Jerry, tell Esther who you are, okay? So he starts to go, I'm a, right? And I say, tell her who you are. So he says, I'm a Messianic Jew. She looked at him in the eyes and she said, Jerry, I know. How do you know? Right? Because you just told me. But this is the you just see what, this poor kid, right? I mean, it's so easy to play a trip on this guy. She said, I know. And he said, how do you know? And she said, I can see it in your eyes. See it in my eyes. Right? And he went for it. That's a pretty irresponsible way. He could jump into Judaism as quickly as he jumped into Christianity and jump right out again. Right? That's why I don't believe in that kind of stuff. Right? Anybody can just jump into something, they can just jump right out. That's why, you know, I think it could be a slow process. I think it should be an intellectual process, one that people are truly in an environment where they're exploring it. I then took him to a rabbi. A fellow by the name of Emanuel Shochet, who is a PhD philosophy professor in a college in Canada. And we got together in his home. So he said, Jerry, let's play to tell the truth. Right? Did you ever play to tell the truth? You know, there's like three panelists and each one saying, I'm Jack Schmo. No, I'm Jack Schmo. And then we're going to ask questions to figure out who's really Jack Schmo over here. So he says, do you know this game? He says, sure. He said, okay, so we're going to play it. He says, so he goes over to his shelf, and he puts on the table three books, right? He puts the Bhagavad Gita, he puts the New Testament, and he puts the Torah. He says, and they're all sitting there. Right? And he says, we're going to now play to tell the truth. And we're going to ask the contestants various questions, okay, about, you know, all kinds of things. And it was just unbelievably brilliant. This fellow was unbelievable. And at the end of the whole thing, I mean, it was just very clear, right? He goes to the New Testament. He shows them the verses that this kid was introduced on the street to, that when the kid was on the street, you know, they showed him in yellow highlighter. You know, he doesn't read what was before. He doesn't read what was after. He said, I would like to just read with you what was before that verse. Because he knew all the verses, but he never read what was before them or after them. So he said, just let's read them. Okay? In a simple reading, he showed him that there is no evidence for anything that he's believing in. Right? Well, I'm watching the whole thing. It was about 2-3 hours, and it was really quite amazing, this whole process that this fellow was going through. Well, it was a very nice rabbi, and Jerry, you saw, had this realization, and it really blew his mind. So we get in the car, and so I say, how do you feel, Jerry? And so he says, that rabbi proved it. I said, what did he prove? He said, just like the prophets say, there'll be a anti-spirit, an antichrist spirit, and he's the antichrist. Right? I said, but he showed you intellectually problems in your approach. Right? He says, and that proves that I'm right. You hear this? That proves that I'm right. Because that's exactly the test of God. Right? And I was blown away by this guy. There was just no way of talking to this fellow. He just never played to tell the truth. He just really just jumped into something. Many people end up jumping into something. Right? They don't realize that they jump into something. But they do. Okay? And that's the amazing thing. In the Shema, it says, if you keep my commandments and X, Y, Z, right, watch out lest your heart should stray and go after other gods. It's very interesting because it doesn't seem to give an option of not going after gods. Right? It's very strange when you think of it. The Bible doesn't give an option for atheism. Right? In the Bible, the real struggle is between monotheism, right, or polytheism, but not atheism. It's like it's not even one of the options of human choices. Now, why would that be? Right? Well, I think in the wise words of Bob Dylan, you're going to have to serve somebody. Okay? Everybody is serving. Everybody is serving. You're either serving your boss, or you're serving your community, or you're serving your people. But everybody is actually looking to be in some mode of service. Okay? And even the atheist is looking for some mode of service. To serve somebody means to in some way feel that I am accommodating the fulfillment of something in the world. And everybody seems to have an intuitive sense of that to be true and to be real, whether they believe in a God or not. Okay? The question if that's an innate sense of serving, and the fact is we all end up serving, right? Whether we're serving our country, or whether we're serving our boss, or whether we're this, it's a very fascinating song. Of course, he wrote it on his Born Again album. What was it called? What was the name of that album? His one Born Again album that he did. It was called Saved, no? It was a picture of, Slow Train Coming. I think that was the name of the album. And there's a picture of a train coming, a guy holding a pickaxe, which actually looked like a cross. And when you look at it, it was really a cross. And so, you know, Dylan went through his Jesus time. And so there's some very deep things in there. It's a very deep album. He's out of Christianity now anyways. But in one of the songs, he really goes through how everybody in their own way is actually in service. And so when a person says, oh, geez, you know, I'm not a service type of person. Oh, geez, I'm not a religious kind of person. Who's not a religious person? We're all looking to serve. We're all, in fact, somehow in a state of service, right? And the question is, did we take some distance and ask ourselves, what is our set of beliefs? And one of the ways to ask yourself what your set of beliefs is in contrast to seeing another set of beliefs, okay? So what we're going to be presenting is Judaism's set of beliefs regarding the nature of reality, okay? I think you will find that a lot of them are what you always believed, right? But that doesn't mean a lot of them are actually what you were successfully portraying in your lifestyle, okay? Which is another issue, okay? But certainly connected to it. So, let's start off with the first set of beliefs, okay? And we're going to draw from the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah tells over a story, a cosmological story, regarding the nature of reality. Okay? This is not a philosophy. Rather, this is a conceptualization of an encounter with is. Right? Very different. Okay? It's not a philosophy. It's an encounter with reality as it is. It's a conceptualization of an encounter with reality. Now, what's the difference? The difference is such. A philosophy generally would be consistent. Okay? Because it's a philosophy. Okay? But the Kabbalah has many contradictions, many paradoxes. How could that be? Because who says the limited language that we have available to us to articulate reality as it is will be sufficient? This is what they're discovering more and more in science. Which is, you know, one of the later realizations that science came to is that we're asking the wrong questions. Okay? Because the way you ask a question is the way you get your answer. So when, you know, if they ask, well, is light a particle or a wave? Who said it's an either or? Do you follow? Who said it's either a particle or a wave? Well, in their experiments, they discovered that it seemed to be behaving like a particle. But then, of blue and waves, they saw it was behaving like a wave. And then they freaked out. They didn't know what's going on. You know, is light schizophrenic? What's wrong with the light? Nothing's wrong with the light. Whatever it is, and we have a limited vocabulary, whether it's a conceptual vocabulary or a verbal vocabulary, which we are using to describe it. Okay? What they realize is it's beyond a wave or a particle. And they realize that there reaches a level where there is a breakdown in our language. Okay? A breakdown in our language. Well, so too in the Kabbalah. There are various times in the Kabbalah which there are clear paradoxes. And the Kabbalah has no problem with that. Because the Kabbalah is not trying to stuff reality into the neat packaging of our classical logical minds. Okay? And that's one of the things that we'll be dealing with quite extensively, which is paradox in Judaism. Now, the mystical story, the mystical conceptualization reality as it's so encountered by the prophets, as it's so encountered by the mystics, is in the beginning, all of reality was a simple, endless light. Okay? That's reality. A simple, endless, divine light, which is called an Or Ein Sof Pashut. Okay? Does that mean reality is a light? No. It means that light is the best word which is suggestive of reality as it is, reflective of reality as it is, but that doesn't mean it is light. Okay? When God wanted to create the world, He caused a withdrawal of His light from the center of His infinite light, which of course, where's the center of an infinite light? Right? So you begin to realize this is not a philosophy. Okay? It is again a conceptualization of a direct encounter with reality. When God wanted to create the world, He caused a withdrawal of His light from the center, creating a vacuum. Alright? God then created vessels within this vacuum and projected a thin ray of His infinite light, which of course, again, what's a thin ray of infinite light? Into these vessels. These vessels, being finite, were not able to receive this infinite light, and they broke. Okay? And the world went into a state of chaos. Okay? The continuing story of the Kabbalah is called the fixing of the vessels, which is the reconstruction of the vessels in a way that they will one day receive the light. And then the Kabbalah ends off with a paradox that the light surrounds the vacuum, and yet the light really still fills the vacuum. And that doesn't make any sense. Because if it surrounds the vacuum, then why is it filling? What does it mean to fill it? And if it's filling it, it doesn't mean it's surrounding it. That's what we'll be talking about for the next 3 weeks. That little metaphor, right? And we'll only be scratching the surface of that metaphor in terms of how it reflects the basic set of beliefs that Judaism has regarding the nature of reality.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.